Thank you for going out, refreshing, and coming back. I'm dropping down now into silence as we listen and learn with this panel dedicated to paying attention to water in the world. One of my closest friends and teachers, a longtime walker of the watershed, every winter we walk the boundaries of the watershed around Redwood Creek and Muir Woods National Monument. My dear friend reminded me of a statement from Jacob Bronowski years ago in the 1980s when he taught at San Francisco State. He spoke very fully on, sadly, a conference that was called The Ascent of Man. So let's say in honor of Houston Smith also, who changed Religions of Man to a new and fresher title. So in this series, Jacob Bronowski observed something that we know well: life is animated water. One friend said, that's too much, just life is water will do. Life is water. And following yoga toes and stretching and moving, to remember, Jacob Bronowski reminds us that every creature is a bag of seawater that leaks. So he asked us to remember and come into touch, as Brooke, as a moderator and felicitator of this panel, will help us listen to the panelists speak about this, that the body is primarily seawater or salt water in our blood, sweat, tears, maybe even amniotic fluid. And that seawater is strong and alive in us. And yet the spinal column has fresh water running up the spine. So strong spine, fresh water in the spine, salt water in the body and blood, tears and sweat. And the salt water in the body is in exact proportion to salt water on planet Earth. The proportion is exactly the same. So proportionally, the proportion of salt water in the human body to fresh water running up our spinal column is in exact proportion to salt and fresh water on planet Earth. Isn't that worthy? That's the ascent of man descends to the real truth, to the bottom of the water. So now, with great delight, our panel on water. And Brooke will let us know what the guidelines are going to be for this panel. Thank you very much for your attention.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brooke Hecht. I'm the president of the Center for Humans and Nature. And we are just so thrilled to be here with our partners again, Point Reyes Books and Black Mountain Circle and the U.S. Forest Service. We really love you guys. We respect you guys. And on that note, Diana, just since you asked us to love you, I love you. Just making sure you know that. I want to do that up front. I love you. I'm in. So we're all here to respond to the call of the forest, and I just want to say up front that we, thinking about the water panel, we're talking about and thinking about water as part of an interconnected whole. And you know, I know we think about interconnections among living beings. But here we also want to be thinking about interconnections among things that at least Western science does not consider to be alive, namely bodies of water, but that's just Western science. And so in this panel, we're thinking about those interconnections. It may sometimes sound, because of our limited language, that when we're speaking of water, we're talking about something in isolation. But that's just our limited language. We're coming at this from an interconnected whole and coming to a call of the forest through the lens of water. So in this panel, we want to be looking at the kinds of questions that are raised by Diana's important work. Questions like, how might we reimagine how we use and manage water in an age of drought and other extreme weather patterns? How do we reconsider the utilitarian and economic language that we use when we refer to water? And how do we acknowledge and promote the interdependence of water, trees, humans, and all of life? And I think above all, that means we're asking one very big question, which is, what are the questions we ought to be asking ourselves in this time, in all of our places, about our relationships with water and how those might change in the future? And to address these questions, we are so lucky to have on our panel Betsy Damon, who is an artist and more, and founders of Keepers of the Water in New York; Linda Sheehan, who is a lawyer and more, and executive director of the Earth Law Center in Redwood City; and Brock Dolman, who is a biologist and a fluid druid, and a co-founder of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center in Sonoma County. So I want to start by asking each one of them to share what inspired them, what brought them to their work, so that you not only have the chance to learn a little bit more about their work and what they're doing in relationships with water, but what inspired them to do that. So Betsy, if you'll start us off, that would be great. Yes.
Aside from all the creeks and dams I made as a child, and that I was always inviting everybody to come and get wet with me, I drove my children across the United States on a 7-week camping trip, and I saw these dry riverbeds that I hadn't seen as a child, and I actually found them beautiful because the rocks were exposed and there was something beautiful there. But I thought, people in cities know nothing about water. I want to cast a dry riverbed in handmade paper. There's not time to tell you how I actually ended up getting the money, but I did get a museum grant to do that. And I went out to Castle Valley, Utah with a team of paper makers, and we made paper from the shrubs, pounding it, and we worked day and night. And one day, after 10 hours of putting this on the river, intimately connected to every detail, the sky was starting to get dark, and we were at 6,000 feet, and the Milky Way came out. And I looked at the Milky Way, and I said, it looks just like the river. And I said, and then I thought, wow, the whole world is patterned by water, and I know nothing. And at that instant, I said, I'm just giving my life, whatever skills I have, whatever I can, to learning water. And the indigenous people call the Milky Way the River of Stones. So it was one of those 30 seconds that changes your life. And so I changed my life at that second and went out to learn. Well, I went to conferences in the United States, and all I learned about was the chemicals and the pollution. I never heard a word about water. What is life? And that took me on a whole journey where I found the work of the Max Planck Institute and have ever since been completely obsessed with this element that creates life, and people have forgotten. They have forgotten it. That's
okay. Thank you so much.
I'm going to read one quick... Oh, okay, go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Read your...
I have the beginning of a book, and that invites people. Listen to the rain. Watch the movement of a stream. Hear the babble of a brook. Tune your heart to the rhythm of the waves. We can. Our heartbeat actually goes with the waves. And if you lie at the edge of the ocean, you can do that. So, water is life, African proverb.
Thank you so much for that, Betsy. Go ahead, Linda.
Thank you. I got my inspiration from working with water. This is on, right? Okay? Yeah. That's better. There we go. As a child growing up in Massachusetts, there was a small forest. Forest is maybe a grand term for it, a patch of woods. But to me, it was a forest. And my friends and I, my siblings, would play there. But I was particularly attracted to the little brook that ran through there. And I would sit there sometimes for hours and just stare at it. And that was at a time where the Clean Water Act hadn't quite kicked in yet. And there were some tanneries upstream. And on occasion, the tanneries would have small accidents. And the waters would run brown and foamy, and the fish would die. And over time, the brook would heal itself, and it would come back. And I would watch that, and I would think, gosh, you know, what tenacity water has, and how can I help this brook take care of itself? And I went into, from that experience, I went into law and policy and even engineering to really study and prepare myself for a lifetime of service coming out of that particular brook. But then my experience doing this work, working for nonprofits over the years, lobbying in Sacramento, passing new laws, having successes with my colleagues that were really wonderful successes, I still felt something wasn't quite there. We were winning battles, but we were losing the war. And I felt like I was letting this brook down. And I started to think back to the same feelings that I had when I was looking at the brook, when I was experiencing myself with this body of water. And it was not the same feeling. It was not the same set of values that I carried into my work doing environmental advocacy. And that's when I started to think that I needed to make a change, that the way that our environmental laws are structured today does not reflect our true values, our true understanding, our intuition of our connection with water, with the earth. And that we need to get back to those values, that sense of belonging, in order to create laws that reflect that sense. Our laws, as Brooke was saying, they're very focused on economics, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, and commodities, and nature as a natural resource. Environmentalists use that term all the time. And that's just such a wrong-headed value. We need to get back to our interconnections, our interdependence with nature, with water especially. And so when I started to think about that, I started to think about how our laws in California allow water rights to be allocated just to humans for human use. And you have to divert the water out of the river to get a water right. So what is valued in California right now is using water for commercial and related purposes. Water in the river has no value. So what I'd like to share, one thing that I'd like to share today is that all of us can do, as Diana was saying earlier, is get together, ordinary people, and reimagine, re-envision what our values are. We jump too fast to solutions without starting with their fundamentals. What are the values? Because if you start with your interdependence with rivers, you'll see immediately our water rights laws are just wrong-headed. That if we are going to have water rights for human use, we at least have to have water rights for the river. The river has a right to flow. It's an inherent right. It is not a river if it doesn't have that ability to flow. And we in California especially need to mold our laws to the river's path. We need to understand our connection. And to do that, we can start today, as we're talking today, to imagine what our values are and build up from there. And one last point out of the presentation that we just saw, the wonderful film with Diana, and they mentioned Japan, and that made me think of a time that I went to Japan to talk about various environmental issues with people there. And the town that we were in, one of the towns was called Suwa, and they have a lake there, Lake Suwa, which is quite famous in its own right. And the people in the town of Suwa were unhappy with the health of the lake and the forest around the lake. And so they re-envisioned their values and their mission statement for the town. And they said, in addition to good jobs and economy, et cetera, they said, we envision a healthy forest with birds that are singing and a singing lake, and that we're connected with that. And that is part of their governing process for the town. All their decisions go back to is it the forest healthy? Are the birds singing? Or do we have a good relationship with the lake? And I invite all of us to start to think about that way of governing ourselves, to get back to our values, our connection with water. And certainly in California, we could use more of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Linda. We definitely are going to want to come back and talk more about those values and our underlying values, but first, the fluid druid.
Oh my goodness. How you feeling, Point Reyes? Woo! I love Point Reyes. Been down here a lot with many of you all working on watershed stuff. So, hi, my name is Brock Dolman. Brock Dolman, it's a dolmens. Think of the druidic stones, of the burial stones, and Brock is an old English word for badger. So, I'll badger you with water for sure. You know, I guess my inspiration for water is, as I'm like all of you, I'm an amphibian, and for 9 months I lived in a sack of solution called the amniotic fluid, and then we came out, and my upbringing is, it's interesting that Japan has come up a number of times. My dad's a retired colonel in the Marine who did 3 tours in Vietnam, so my upbringing actually was in Okinawa in Japan. All my earliest memories are catching tadpoles in Japanese rice paddies as a 3, 4, 5-year-old and learning Japanese, and everywhere we went, from Southern California to our family's land near the Tetons and Yellowstone in Idaho, it was frogs and snakes and turtles and fishing and getting muddy and the smell of a willow riparian corridor is the oldest memory I have. If I go into a creek corridor and smell willow, salix, whatever that salicylic acid, that healing sense of that pain relief. And I think, as Aldo Leopold would remind us, in essence, those of us who have an ecological education live in a world of wounds, and so maybe going to the riparian corridor for a little bit of aspirin, natural healing aspirin, was part of a kid growing up in a realm where I wasn't afflicted with nature deficit disorder. I was hyper fluent and engaged to this thing, although I had no academic training. I then go and get some academic training, and so I'm a UC Santa Cruz graduate, banana slugs, and I double majored in conservation biology and agroecology, and I was really interested in human land use and how we provision our settlements, our urban, suburban, rural, our forestry, rangeland, agriculture, and how can we do that in a manner that's more ecologically emulating. And my primary profession for many years is I'm an endangered species vertebrate biologist. So ornithology and ichthyology, birds and fish and mammals and such. And I worked in Big Basin for many years. I've been in every old growth forest, redwood forest in the state as a marbled murrelet biologist, as spotted owl biologist, peregrine falcons, red-legged frogs. And what became really clear to me doing environmental impact reports in California and looking for the last of the last of the last tiger salamander and long-toed salamander, is that when the water cycle in a place was compromised, the carrying capacity for life was accordingly compromised, because you don't live on planet Earth, you live on planet water, and it's the only known planet in the universe where life is endemic. Life's endemic to planet water. And that's because, as Jacques Cousteau would remind us, the water cycle and the life cycle are the same cycle. And so I figured out this epiphany, and I started beginning to try to think like a watershed. And those of us who work in watersheds, we begin in the top of the watershed, what's often referred to as the headwaters. But I realized I had to start in the headwaters, which was the water in my own head up here. And I had to mitigate my own cerebral imperviousness to infiltrate the information into this system and mitigate the gullies in the cerebellum and reconnect the floodplains up in the headwaters here to begin to think like a watershed. And ultimately, if a river is going to flow, it has to start from the ridgeline to the river mouth for the entirety of the basin of relations. And so I did trainings for many years called Basins of Relations, Starting and Sustaining Community Watershed Groups. Because at some point, if we're going to restore ecosystems, we have to do ecosystem restoration. And what's the new storyline that the ecosystem believes? Is the planet a community or a commodity? And I believe, as the call of the forest, of the spirit of water, is that we are all communitarians in this collaborative, convivial container of co-creation together.
So, all right, so, yeah, Betsy, you want to riff on that a little?
I can never riff
like Brock can. But I don't know how many of you know that our brain and our heart and our stomach share the same cells. And therefore, they are always talking to each other through these watery things all the time. So all these efforts to separate our brains from our hearts and our gut are just so bogus and self-limiting and self-destructive. And that is unfortunately kind of where everyone is. Well, can you prove it? Or, you know, what? You know, and instead of like, going with your gut is a good thing. You know, walking in the forest.
Yeah. See, you riffed on it very well. Very well. So, This morning, we've all been lucky to travel many different places through the film and through what people are saying so far. But I want, Brock, I want you to help us out and root us right here in this place and help us think about drought. Help us think about the drought here in California, and maybe also tell us about your concept of drought and what that means to you.
Okay. Well, I think what's amazing is to really imagine, some folks will say that here in the Bay Area in general, we're the place where Canada and Mexico meet. And this amazing place called a Mediterranean climate, only five of them on the planet, very unique. And yet this area here, literally Marin County, is the southern tip of the temperate rainforest, where there's a contiguous conifer connected corridor and canopy from Marin all the way up to Alaska. And then it breaks, and then we pick up Santa Cruz Mountains, we pick up the Santa Lucias. But the old growth redwood starts here and moves north. And so there's this temperate rainforest with Mexico, with a Sierra Nevada to the west, the longest contiguous mountain range in the lower 48, and this amazing wetland, the delta, the San Joaquin-Sacramento Delta. And this landscape was patterned for abundance. We don't live in a water-scarce area out here. We live in a storage-scarce area because we get lots of water in 3 months, and then we have this long natural dry period in a Mediterranean climate. And so the fluctuation of even in the fact that this may be as a dry moment, one of the driest periods that we've seen in this area for, say, 800 years or so, based on tree ring data and looking at submerged trees in Lake Tahoe and Mono Lake and such, that the landscape here has evolved with these organisms called forests and the prairies and the woodlands to be water harvesting machines, water purifying machines, groundwater replenishing machines. They elongate and infiltrate and extend the duration of the fact that, how is it that a river runs in November here if it hasn't seen rain since February? It's because the watershed should be a living, breathing sponge as vegetation. Trees are like lakes, are rivers that flow into the forest as a whole lake, from ridgeline to river mouth. Then these hominids come in, these European ones, and they have this fancy idea that the land's a commodity. And deforestation leads to desertification and system desiccation and death pretty quickly. And so remove the original forest, plow the prairies, create impervious surfaces, plummet with a bunch of roads and culverts. Nothing in nature mimics a road, as Danny Higgins would say. Derange the hydrologic function, increase the runoff, so the rate of this incredible distilled water leaves the land faster, floods you in the winter, and doesn't infiltrate the groundwater piggy bank in the summer. And so the extremity of the intensity of this natural dry period is anthropogenically amplified in the lack of resilience of the landscape because of our hydrologically illiterate land abuse scenario that has only been an extraction-based. We've externalized the costs of the impact of this living system onto the fact that we have these hydrological watersheds that aren't working. So blaming drought as if that's somehow we get to punt to the natural cycle, when in fact the condition of the system has been so compromised, and therefore we need to step up and begin to, again, think like a watershed and have a sense that with water, we need to slow it, spread it, sink it, store it, and share it. And that ultimately is really a reverential rehydration retrofit that's based on resiliency, again, from ridgeline to rivermouth. And every human land use has to rethink and ask the question, what would water want? And design accordingly. And forest will be a really good answer to the question of what would water want, generally, in most places.
Thank you so much, Brock. Right. The bad news is that the story that you tell, although without probably such fabulous alliteration, can be told all over the world. That's the bad news.
Read a book by John Perlin called Forest Journey, The Role of Wood in the Development of Civilization. If you would like to get the Sumerians through the Fertile Crescent and the Tigris-Euphrates Delta and the Cypriots and the Cretans and the Greeks and the Moors and on and on, and Easter Island and the Mayans, and you cut your forest and you keep cutting it, and it's a one-way street to collapse.
The good news is, though, that since this is echoed everywhere, we can work on this together, and we can learn from one another, and we can do this together. Betsy, I'm still working on rooting us. I've loved that. I want to root us deeper in this place. for people who haven't been to Betsy's amazing installation, just two blocks from here, maybe you can do it at lunch. I went this morning. It's deeply moving. Betsy, can you help us picture this, your inspiration for it, and then also how it connects with some of your other amazing artwork in different parts of the world? But start with us here first. Root us here and what you did here.
Okay. Well, Steve Costa called me up and asked me if I'd make sculpture. And I did see a tree instantly. But I will say this, I have not made work that doesn't function totally for the environment and in the environment. I decided that as an artist 20 years ago, that I wanted everything I did to... I didn't want to have to sell a lot of work and deal with all that. I wanted it all to be work, really, for the environment. So this was a little bit of a leap, but it was... I didn't realize that I was probably channeling Diane. I'm serious. And then the community with Nancy Stein leading it had signed up to help. And I arrived off a plane really jet-lagged, and we went to work and in 3 days created three different sculptures, which are called the Poetry of Trees. I also didn't know that the first language originated in the trees. Diane told me that. I think we all, as a collective mind, the people from the community, and some of them are here, raise your hand if you worked on this project. Raise it high, yeah. There's other people, Scott. We really became a collective mind. And the minute I had a thought, someone else actually had it, or someone had it, and it was like, great. And we did the work of a month in 3 days. And so the trees have different names. They're on the wall. You can have your own name. You can add to it. We have materials back there, and people can add prayers, sayings, and there's stuff scattered around for you to use also. And it really was a conversation. All our materials were sourced. They were from trees that had been cut down or fallen down or something like that. So we didn't buy any wood from anything. And there's a comment about trees being made into woods on one of our sculpture. And it'd be great to hear your feedback, because this just happened beautifully, beautifully. And it has a lot to do with the Point Reyes community, that it could happen that way. And I felt very humbled and privileged to be this, to do it. My other work, I'll just say this, is I ended up in China, not by will, but designing it's an inner city park that's a total water cleaning system that became a world model. And it contains everything, like, the fish can come back. The kingfishers were there. It's a small park. Like Diana said, you can take every place, small or large, we have to do this. But we have to make them real. I mean, I'll cry when I say it. You know, no more fountains that spew water in the air that do nothing. No more buildings with ponds that reflect the building and no movement and no life in them. No more separation of our water systems, our streams, to decorate something. We cannot do that. We cannot do it. And I could go on a long time about this. and it's completely together, quantumly together with the forests. With these two things, hooking up our water systems and the forest, we beat climate change in 10 years. But it's going to take... What I say in my book is it's going to take deciding. Yeah. Deciding. Not watching, not thinking I'd like to do that, not, you know, dreaming someday or I'll join someone else who will start it. It's going to take each of us deciding. And whether it's your backyard, you decide first to collect water or whatever. Anyway, okay.
I was so moved reading about this work, which I know happened in different parts of the world, not only because of what was being built and the way the community was being engaged, but there were businesses, there were jobs, there were hydroponic farms, there were water, paper-making, I don't want to say factory, that's not right, but paper-making industry. How did it work with the children? The children would peddle, and the water would be moved. And before you say it, though...
That's a vision I have.
That's a vision?
The next piece I'm working on is children move water. Water is connecting the energy movement together and creating... It's for a community that I just worked in for 4 years. It was a very, very poor community, and they've become the model for Pittsburgh development is Living Waters of Larimer. So, but now creating it, like, what about our playgrounds, you know? They could collect water. They could have fabulous water collecting features from the sky that would then become part of the playground, and the children would move and something else would happen, and, you know, you'd get connection. We have to stop having boxes. And our legal system makes it really hard, but we have to do it.
This would be a very different kind of playground, I think, that we would all like to be in. And I think one of the other pieces of that work is that you were working to change metaphors in a very important way in community, where wastewater became living water.
Yeah.
And that, so now, Linda, I feel like that's at the core of your work, is changing some of these big metaphors and how we think about, in particular, how we think about rights. And I want to dig in with everyone and have a conversation about rights. But you mentioned earlier, and a couple people mentioned, you know, we think about the basic human right to have water. We think about Flint. We don't need to say anything more there. But then we think of the rights of nature to have water, for bears to drink, for fish to swim, the right of the river itself, as you said, to flow, of an aquifer to exist. This is what you spend every day working on. I mean, help us, I know, thank you so much for that, and help us think about that transition from just thinking about our own rights or a corporation's rights to water to what it might look like if we really expand that notion.
Yeah, so the idea of rights, I think, is rights is a legal tool, and it's also this metaphysical concept, but it's not ultimately where we want to end up, of course. Ultimately, where we want to end up is to naturally and reflexively and intuitively exercise our responsibilities towards the natural world every day, towards water, and without even thinking about it. I was at the World Water Forum in... Marseille a few years ago, lots of corporate, you know, big corporate entities, Veolia, you know, these Suez, these big companies, yeah, that privatize and commodify water, as well as a number of NGOs doing their own alternative water forum as well. But I did go to some of the sessions at the World Water Forum, and there was a young Chumash indigenous person from California trying to explain this idea of responsibilities to, you know, perhaps some corporate attorneys. Whether he was successful in conveying the message, I'm not sure, but to me, it was incredibly powerful, because he said, before we can even go on to the water with our canoe to perhaps catch a fish or do something else, we have to purify ourselves. We have to purify our thoughts. If we have negative thoughts, we have to breathe through them and release them, because we have to enter the water with respect. And that's how we should be living with water. Unfortunately, right now in California, we have a system of water law that prevents us from thinking that way. It's premised on these values that we hold about water as a commodity, that water rights are allocated for use of the water. And even the human right to water is a bill that was only passed after a number of tries, year after year, by advocates. And it's not a true right in the way that water use in California is a right. It's voluntary. It's if there's funding. There are many, many qualifications on that. And it's not implemented in any meaningful way. So the idea of rights is something that is really, it's a correction I think of it as. We have rights that are allocated incorrectly right now. Corporations have rights. Water users have rights. So we need to start to say, you know what, waterways have a right to flow too, and watch people's reactions and say, well, and if they say, well, I don't really understand, then that is a great conversation opener to say, well, how are we going to learn to live with water if we don't recognize water as our partner on Earth, as a fellow Earth citizen? It's something that we need to sort of purify ourselves before we think about interacting with water, to realize the magnitude of that relationship. So I think that that idea of rights is something that we need to start to talk about and to put into our law to force us in this direction. And on that path, we will start to appreciate our responsibilities towards water. So just two examples, related examples. One in Pittsburgh. You mentioned Pittsburgh just now. Pittsburgh has a local law, an ordinance that they passed recognizing the rights of waterways to be healthy and to flow. And it came out of a threat to those waterways, fracking. Fracking was being threatened, and people in Pittsburgh said no fracking. The corporations don't have the right to frack, and that waterways in Pittsburgh have the right to be healthy, to be free of these fracking contaminants. I worked with Santa Monica, the city of Santa Monica, to pass their own ordinance. They call it a sustainability rights ordinance. There's copies in the back, and if it runs out, just fill out the little sheet, and I'll email you one. And this ordinance also says that natural communities, not natural resources, natural communities within Santa Monica have inherent rights to exist and to thrive. And they mentioned specifically in the ordinance the groundwater aquifer within Santa Monica. And so now I'm working with community members in Santa Monica to try to strengthen their groundwater use, their groundwater controls, because with this ongoing and drought, I could talk a little bit about drought later. This ongoing lack of rain that we've been having in California, people are putting a lot of extra pressure. And in California, we don't have good groundwater controls. But this local ordinance empowers people, enables people to respect the water that's there and to put in stronger controls that we could put in under state law. So again, it's a community recognizing its value, its interaction with water, and reflecting those values through articulation about rights in law for waterways, and then using that to improve their responsibilities towards water. So it's a pattern that any community can take, and it's a great conversation for a community to have.
Yeah, I know Betsy wants to follow on this, and I love all the enthusiastic applause after each comment. It's so nice to feel the love up here, so thanks, you guys. Betsy and Brock, when you respond and riff on this, one of the things I'm wondering about, one of the things I loved about what you said, Linda, was that the rights conversation is a correction and it's a stepping stone, because there is kind of this tension between the idea of rights as an individual thing and community, which is something shared. And I know both Brock living in an intentional community, Betsy, and all of your work on building resilience into communities, help us kind of figure this out, because obviously when you think about Flint, the right to clean water just cries out. But we want to make sure we don't, or that somehow we can bring together the idea of rights, responsibility, and community. So Betsy, go ahead.
Well, just a reminder, the United States was one of two countries in the UN that did not vote for water as a human right. And FYI, if it's a need, you can charge people for it. If it's a right, it's like the right to life, right? So South Africa actually has that every human being gets a certain amount of water for free. And Bolivia also has water as a same situation. But the other thing that came to mind is a businessman bought the right to mine the water underneath Mount Shasta for $350,000 from five people, and it was a legal deal. Many years ago, I supported the people to fight that, just with fundraising and stuff like that. But in the United States, we can sell off our water. You can sell it off, and California's water was being sold off. And anybody can sell it off. So these are huge things that you all need to know. I've been in Larimer when they realized that 120 million gallons of rainwater fell on this plateau every year. I said to them, well, what can we do with that? And so first it has to be collected, and that means changing an infrastructure. But then there's you know, all kinds of things from just street cleaning. We use drinking water to clean streets. You probably do too. And there's just so much that the public isn't aware of. So what would it mean to collect the, in certain situations it's really appropriate, probably Flint gets lots of rain, and have people educated enough to know what they could do. But to turn this ship around is gonna take huge intention. We are on this ship. Your water entities want to own everything and sell it back to you. We are on that ship. So we need to change it.
Betsy, in the communities that you've worked with, these beautiful communities that we've spoken of, just give us a little list so we can picture them, we can feel them a little bit. What are the qualities that they have?
Well, they have the most successes are from the grassroots, where people already have some organization, but maybe not knowledge. And that's where the change is gonna come. It's gonna come from you organizing, us organizing community. So but what was amazing is in this community, very poor, people listened to the radio about the spirit of water. They knew Emoto. They knew the same books I read. They had all this knowledge. They just didn't know that they could take charge. So we walked the land. I taught geography, sort of, you know, landform and water flow and where it goes. Immediately, it took like two or three sessions of mapping, 2 hours each, for people to understand what could happen in their community and then go down and advocate in the offices of the city. And at the same time, know that they needed these and these engineers, but the power, the engineer was in service to them, not them being exploited from the top. So I'm making it sound easy, okay? But there was a group, the policy guy, okay, so the white guys, okay, were not comfortable. They were not comfortable talking to the African heritage people. They just were not comfortable. And one black man would say to me, what's wrong with them? And I'd say, you know, they're just shy. They're a little bit held back. Their culture has kept them a little bit restrained. So, you know, I'd arrange eating at the cheap Chinese restaurant or meeting on the corner or ways that we would be digging ditches together or doing things together. So it took a long time for people to get comfortable. It took like almost 2 years to bridge those gaps so that it was a real team. But the real leadership was from the grassroots. And that's a mistake we almost make without even thinking about it. The same in China. I didn't lead. They led me. They led me. Now, I had to learn an awful lot as a USer to let that happen. But yes, it was my idea. But a minute I planted that seed, the Chinese had all kinds of ideas that went way beyond, like, let's go out and get rare species and plant them in the garden. You know, let's go and get what, and so they are saved the dinosaur plants. You know, it's biodiverse. I didn't think of all that. I didn't know all that, right? So we don't, you know, anyway.
Okay, Brock. Actually, we're going to have questions from the audience in a little bit, have a conversation. But first, Brock, what are you feeling? You want to talk community or you want to talk language? Because I got questions on both ends for you.
Those are synonyms where I come from. But
okay, good. All right. So we're going to...
But language, I am interested in language right now.
Because I have a special question for you on language. And a couple people have already said it. We've been touching on it about... water as a resource, water as an asset. We're talking economic language here. And I'm reminded last year, Melissa Nelson said, what if we thought of water as a relative instead of a resource?
And that really stuck with me. So thanks, you guys, for last year, Geography of Hope. I've really carried that with me, loving it for the last year. But you've had me thinking, it's not just resource and asset, but what about watershed and drainage and ditch? Like, help us out with our language here so that we can really start to speak respectfully about water.
Where you just went is exactly where I have it written down here. Melissa Nelson is a really good friend of mine. We went to undergrad at UC Santa Cruz, and they're having the Cultural Conservancy, which Melissa Nelson is a director of, is having their 30th anniversary today. We're missing a party right now. I want to be there with them. But was it tomorrow? I'm sorry. I have to be teaching a permaculture course tomorrow. So tomorrow. So all of you guys, go support them over there. But what Melissa's referring to in her lineage as Ojibwe is actually, and I had the opportunity at Bioneers 2 years ago to ask Orin Lyons, who's the faith keeper of the Onondaga clan, to clarify, was this quote that I've been attributing to him for years, was it in fact correct? And he very graciously, as an elder does, confirmed that it is indeed correct. So what Melissa's riffing on is Orin's quote that says, what you people, European white folks, what you people call natural resources, our people call relatives. And so to this idea of, so there's a theory of relativity, right? It's a kin-centric model, not kingdoms, but kindoms. And we are all related from our bacterial progenitors, those endosymbionts, with our mitochondrial relations of our maternal DNA, right, out of Africa. And for those of us who are hybrids with Neanderthals, I'm in the 96th percentile of Neanderthal genome, loud and proud cave person here, right? Hybrid vigor in this arena. And the opportunity, I think, is to the Chumash story we heard before, is that indigenous people, and all of them that I've ever been around with and had the blessing to be with, and when I'm with Joanne and others, indigenous people had a system of water rights. They had it nailed down. And the Chumash gentleman was speaking of his water rights. How'd they spell it? R-I-T-E-S. The rights of water, the right of passage. Water rights. We have this crazy thing, R-I-G-H-T, water rights, which ends up acting like water wrongs because we fixate on my right, my private property, my right, my bill of rights, but we didn't get a bill of responsibilities. So in the absence of responsibilities, we legislate in the Clean Water Act, Fishable, Swimmable, Drinkable, Safe Drinking Water Act, but and then all of a sudden it's big government off my back because somehow my private property is being, quote, infringed upon by the takings of the public trust for my private poverty, because the commonwealth, the wealth of the commons, has been enclosed. And it's all insane. So I'm up for water rights, and it's a rite of passage, the R-I-T-E-S on this one. And that really is our relationship as relatives, and then in servitude, us hominids with these opposable hands and frontal lobes, how do we reclaim our reverential reciprocity with rigor to be engaged as keystone species to support the keystone processes of helping conjure earth, air, fire, and water to create conditions conducive for life once again. And we get to be actually help do that. The only other organism in the Northern Hemisphere that's better at creating conditions conducive for life is the beaver, but we'll talk about them later.
I love it. I love it. I'm an ecologist. My background is in ecology, and I so often think of the evolutionary interconnectedness we all have that you were just describing. You know, we're 99% related to chimpanzees. We're a quarter, 25% related to rice. Love that one. And we share a lot of our genes with yeast. So love that. So then I come back and think about all of you guys. We are intimately related. We are very close relatives, all of us. Even, you know, everyone on the plane, as I was driving really slowly, my Midwestern self, everyone was passing me, you know, on the road up here. I was like, hey, it's another relative. They're going by. And, but there's something about the water conversation that's making me remember. There's so many different ways we can remember that relationship and that interconnectedness. And today, all of our panel and our introducers, speakers, that coherence. And just before we go to questions from our relatives in the audience, if you guys have any 30 seconds each or something to just give us a picture, you who have worked so intimately with water, if you have anything to say about that coherence and interconnectedness. A lot of us do know about that genetic, but help us feel it with that water.
Well, I just one point that related to that is you talked a few times about, you know, rooting ourselves in our sense of place, but this larger, you know, sense of relationship and kinship is truly global. And we in California, we think about our water situation, and we'll talk about climate change and how that impacts our water situation this afternoon. But we need to think globally and about our kin in other countries. And just as one example, scientists have now shown that deforestation in Brazil in the Amazon impacts California's water situation significantly. So our snowpack in the Sierra is directly affected by deforestation in Brazil. So there are connections and upon connections that we barely understand. And so we need to think locally, think globally and act locally. But, you know, we also need to act globally too. And we need to reach out to our kin and our relatives in other countries and see how we can work together and support each other, because this is an interconnected web of life that we're a part of. And there's so much that we can do to start to make that stronger.
Brilliant. Well, I start out every talk in Larimer saying, I'm standing up here talking to you because I'm water. And you're listening to me because you're water. And, you know, we are all so connected. And there's a lot written about how we... We're all so connected. And we're in a culture that insists on separation. And having worked in a culture that isn't part of the culture, for example, like our certain whole Tibetan villages, they're not allowed to cut the forest because it would impact the water. Everyone knows that, whole things like that. So, getting us. Acknowledging our deep, deep, deep connection that's inherently here all the time is, right now, I think it would have a quantum effect about what we could do and where the impacts would be. Let's see.
Well, it strikes me that at this time of an emergency, we have to figure out how to see the emergence of the emergent property, which is that the whole of planet water is greater than the sum of the Mickey Mouse molecules. And you all ultimately are mostly water by volume, and stay hydrated, because being low-drated is bad for people and it's bad for watersheds. And how do we reclaim our relationship with this cycle? Because it's ultimately about our ability to sustain the cycles of life is what sustainability about. Right, it's reciprocal relations on this amazing, turning, beautiful blue ball here that's currently in equilibrium, as we heard earlier, in the equinox, in this moment of equilibrium, of balance, in this rights, this wrongs, rights and responsibilities, commodities, communities. Where do you want to line up? Which path would you like to take? The forested path to do some forest bathing, or the asphalt path, the hard path? And I don't want to argue about whose ass is at fault for that stuff, but take the forested path. The wide and wiggly, wondrous path of water will lead you on. And so go out with your sign like I do and just put it out and say, we'll work for water.
We want to hear from you guys. What do you think? What are you wondering? What are you thinking? Yes.
Thank you so much. I heard an interesting talk the other day about blood health, and one of the things they talked about was the importance of water and hydration. And one thing that this person made a comment about, and I don't know if y'all know about it, but she said that depending on the type of water, like how it's running, has an effect on your hydration. So river waters hydrate us more, but they're too polluted to drink from. She talked about molecular size, you know, about, you know, different kinds of waters. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I'll just say this. In China, they say that the person who can live next to very healthy water becomes so healthy they can see the health in everybody else. But what kept me with my work, because I went totally poor, no one believed me, was I visited a sacred water site in China, and I drank this water, and my whole body, I could feel my molecules respond. And it was a water bottling factory slashed into a mountain in an old growth forest that had been under the guidance of the Tibetans for 2,000 years, the source of their health, and that had been taken. And I drank that water, and I said to myself, I can't stop working on this. I was going to stop because I hit wall after wall. And so, yes, the water you drink does make a big difference, but your worrying about it won't help. That will be contradictory.
I guess one of my favorite quotes in this idea of waters is actually Aldo Leopold had a number of amazing children. One of them was Luna Leopold, who's considered one of the founders of the modern science of fluvial geomorphology. Fluvial flow, geo-earth morphology shape. It's the nerds who trip on, you know, wiggly creeks and deltas and such. And he has this great quote that basically says, the health of our waters is the principal measure of how we live on the land. And so if you're not willing to get on your hands and knees and drink out of any creek in your watershed from ridgeline to river mouth, because the quantity or quality of water has been degraded due to the human settlement in place over time, you've got a serious indictment on your land use practice and the longevity and resiliency of that system. And so the health of the waters are what you're willing to put in your body, what you're willing to swim in, what you're willing to have a tree take up in it is critical. And, yeah, it's just fundamental. But go nerd out on Victor Schauberger, Theodor Schwenk, Johann Grander, some of these crazy German Austrian water wonks who get into the orbital spins and the work of the flow forms that Betsy used so eloquently in the Living Water Garden in Chengdu, John Wilkes, Jennifer Green. There's a lot of really fun water folks out there.
Well, yeah, the molecular nature of water, its power. Think about what gets created because of water. Think about it. How powerful must that be? I call it aggressive. The most aggressive creator we have is water. Now that is, and I did that just to, like, wake up. You know, water degrades in pipes. Every so many hundred, whatever, feet of pipe, they have to add something to keep your water clean. Another, ammonia, you know, chlorine, blah, blah, blah. Not only that, they added, they mandated it had to be ordered to go in your water in 1988, regardless whether your city had really clean water or not. They had to add chlorine. So there's so much to understand here, but yes, it's crucial. It's crucial to every, and not only to us, but to the newts and the frogs and everything else. They're being challenged by the degradation of our waters.
Common question has to do with change on the grassroots level. Could somebody say something about whether or not change will come from water boards and water agencies that we have all across the state of California?
It will not.
No. We're not talking about waterboarding here now.
No, I could tell you from personal experience, having been doing that for 20 years, literally still doing it a little bit. The best you can do at that level is maybe kind of keep things like sort of static for a bit, you know, sort of make the worst, push it off for a little bit longer while you do your own advocacy and build a new model. Because what they do is they implement the laws that are already in front of them. They don't create law except for regulations, which again come out of the laws that are in front of them. It's up to all of us to set the values and to write the new laws that reflect those values, then put those in front of water boards, hopefully comprised of including people who represent water, you know, speak for water. They don't have seats on water boards for water. And to implement it that way. But right now, they're just enforcing the laws that we have, which are not the laws that we want.
I think we have another question in the back.
So I've had this idea that legislation puts power into the hands of a non-committed government. So I'm just curious, how do we legislate in such a way that will unleash the responsibility that we need, or do we even legislate that?
I do think that legislation is important to be able to guide us, and we are going to have laws regardless. And so we want to put in place laws that are going to guide us properly. We're too big to be able to function effectively without some kind of a formal guidance for all of us. That said, especially at the local level, you should be doing both action and legislation. And so that's what they're trying to do. For example, in Santa Monica, is they put in place the sustainability rights ordinance, not because somebody was coming in with fracking or gravel mining or something that was threatening them, but they were worried after Citizens United, after these big Supreme Court decisions, that corporations, other entities were going to come into their community and say, hey, you wanted solar? Too bad. You know, you're going to get hydrofrack fuel. That's just too bad for you. So they have a sustainable city plan that they put together from the ground up, and that it's a very good plan for a city that size. And they want this ordinance to support that. And so they passed it to say that, you know, corporations don't trounce our rights, that we have the right to decide that we want this type of a city and to grade ourselves on our progress, and that the natural communities have a right to exist and thrive. And we're going to make our decisions based on that. And in their sustainable city plan, they reference back to say, we need to make sure all of our decisions reflect that fact. So it allows them to evolve their actions on the ground. And so when they're put up with pressure against outside entities or inside entities that say, I want, you know, the cheaper hydrofrack gas or whatever that might be, they can say, you know, this is our law. This is what we're following. And it's a great backstop and guidance tool.
I'll just follow up a little bit. There is a new generation of younger engineers. They're bioengineers. Everything is already spec'd, okay? What your pipe is, what you do, how the fittings are, everything. And they're spec'd they're spec'd to go in a pipe and send your water away. It's all already coded and all there. So it takes an unusual person to say, okay, I'm going to help you change that. You know, I know how to do it differently. So let's try this differently. And then you try it on a small scale, and they go, wow, man, that's cool. And you can scale up. There's a lot of interventions like that, but you have to understand what they are and get the people that are on board to want to do it. But there is a younger generation coming along that's educated. Now, wastewater treatment plants are going to have to be moved. They can't keep spilling into our waters. We have a low dilution rate here, which it's criminal. So there's all these things. Okay.
Okay, we have one more question in the back.
So this is a celebration disguised as a question. I'm wondering if you're aware of two new bills, Assembly Bill 2525 and Senate Bill 1294, that actually use the words watershed approach to California landscapes. This is huge. And I'm wondering whether you see a tipping point about to happen, and whether you think it's going to be feasible to reclaim our watersheds through our municipal and home landscapes.
Yeah, we're looking for a watershed moment, literally and figuratively here. I don't know if it's, when we think of tipping points, it's a point that tips, and then it goes quickly. So for our watershed lifeboats, that we want those to tip in the right direction and actually hold water instead of bail it out. I think, having worked in Sacramento on legislation and having worked in Sonoma County on water law, I can tell you that I'm not sure tipping points happen in the legislative arena. There's slides. There's slow slides with a bunch of people pushing. It's sort of like Sisyphus. But for instance, gray water, though, we did, a group of us in state years ago got a legislature to write a bill that required that we rethink the California Uniform Plumbing Code and sent that to something called HCD, Housing Community Development. And a group of us went to Sacramento, my carbon footprint I feel guilty about, and we rewrote Chapter 16A of the California Uniform Plumbing Code so that now it's legal in everywhere in California to put in a laundry-to-landscape system with 10 simple rules into your yard or a branch drain from your shower by with a plumbing permit. So there is the opportunity to legalize sustainability, but it's incremental at the legislative level. And then the other business end of this deal is actually it's called general plans, and every city and county has to have a general plan. And Sonoma County rewrote it's called GP 2020 back in the late 90s, and they have required elements, housing, transportation. And I looked at this thing, and I'm like, weird. The element of life, water, doesn't even have its own element. I think we should have a standalone water resource element. I convinced the board to do that. We're the first county in the state to have a standalone water resource element back in 2000. And in the preamble to that, we slipped in the words, water is a human right. And it's been sitting there on the books, but it was just one of these little incremental pieces. I don't know if it's a tipping point. So the problem is that right now the pipe shed people are super happy because we got this atmospheric river. It showed up. The reservoirs are full, and therefore the big plugs of dirt and concrete with a pipe and a valve. The pipe shed people are like, yay, the drought's over. I can't wait to wash the sidewalk off and water my lawn this summer. The watershed drought, the ecological drought, the hydrological drought within the California floristic province, it ain't over because the conditioned landscape ain't over. So pipe sheds versus watersheds is a really different reality.
Closing. No, Betsy, if you want to riff and then a closing comment from both of you.
Just one brief point. I mean, after banging my head against the wall, lobbying in Sacramento for years and years and years, I would say the best way to get their attention is to do something really positive locally, make a model. The plastic bag ban is one example where the legislature wouldn't even listen to a statewide plastic bag ban. So my colleagues went door to door in communities and said, do you want this? And people said, yeah, we could do that. Sure, we're going to do that. And so many communities started doing it that the plastic bag manufacturers went to Sacramento and they said, either you figure out how to get rid of this or we have a statewide ban because we can't handle all these different bans. It's confusing. So it was by doing this locally and making it happen, that's how you are able to create a model that people can use. So if you want watershed management, do watershed management. Put it in your local community plan, put it in your local ordinances, make it happen, make it work, and get your friends in other counties to do it too. Then you've got a model, and then something in Sacramento will actually stick because you could say, look, they did it here. I don't know why you can't do it someplace else.
Great.
Okay. Well, you know the gray water gorillas in Oakland, they finally made it legal. 8 years ago, I did a workshop in L.A., and they had all the engineers coming from the city. And we talked, and you know they all work right on the beaches. Their main thing was to clean up the beaches. And I said, really? For hundreds, millions and millions of dollars. I said, really? There's nothing to start up at the top of the watershed? Nothing. Well, right, I just got a phone call, and the government, they're starting at the top of the watershed now to hold the waters up and infiltrate them into the land. So, but it wasn't even a thought 6-7 years ago.
I'm glad we're ending on a positive note. And I also want to end with a question, because the Center for Humans and Nature is about asking questions, important questions. And I'm going to cite Brock, because I'm stealing it exactly from what he said yesterday. Betsy was saying away, you know, the water goes into the pipes and it goes away. And Brock said yesterday, when we have reached peak away, what would it look like to redesign human work, human communities in a way that is just and reverential? What would it look like for whom and where? So I love that question. Thank you for that question. Thank you, Brock. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, all of you, for sharing this with us. We appreciate it so much.